Okay, good morning. We'll get started. Our learning this morning, we have two sponsors, sponsored by Jain Gita Liske, in observance of the first yahrzeit of Gita's father, Joseph Schachter, Rabbi Yosef Chaim ben Moshe Ariel of Ashalom, and also by Sharon and Hilary Hertan, commemorating the 20th yahrzeit of Hilary's father, Melvin Hertan, Yisrael Mordechai ben Elazar, all of Ashalom and Neshamot HaValiyot. A learning will be in their memory. May their memory continue to be a blessing. Amen. So we turn to Yud Bet. We start on the daf, so you don't need anything extra, and we will finish on the daf, so don't need anything extra. And we are in full throttle interpretive mode. There are no conceptual discussions, no halachic applications, no attachments to other discussions elsewhere. We are now going verse by verse through the first chapter of the Megillah, with Chazal offering their interpretation and filling in the picture, so to speak, of the background and the atmosphere. What we have so far established, other than the 10 Mishnayot of the chapter, which detailed flexibility, when you can read the Megillah, depending on where you live, and then a whole series of seeming similarities, Shabbos and Yom Tov, Shabbos Yom Kippur, excuse me, a Metzora who is for sure, Metzora who goes into a suspense for a week while we determine whether he really is a Metzora, and a number of similarities, including the different instantiations of the temple, whether it was in Shiloh, Yerushalayim, and then after that 10th Mishnah, where we said there's only one difference between Shiloh and Yerushalayim, whether the Kedusha, whether its sanctity is eternal, or whether it ends with the destruction. And then we shifted to an interpretation of the Megillah, which began with introductions. We had 11 or 12 different ways in which the sages introduced the Megillah when they would teach it. And we said that there was very little in common in terms of how they frame the story. According to one of the sages, he would introduce the Megillah by saying, you want to know why the Purim story happened? Because the people weren't learning enough Torah. They weren't attached enough to their own tradition, so God turned the world against them. And it was traditional, what we call contrapposto, a tit-for-tat punishment, measure for measure. You weren't paying attention, God's going to force you to pay attention. And it's a reaction to something in the present. We had another sage who said, you want to know why this happened? Very simple reason. Military failure. When you conquer the land of Israel, Shaul failed to eliminate all the enemies that he was told to. And guess what? Someone survived. They had a child. They fostered this hatred over generations. Haman arose to power. And you pay the consequences if you don't deal with your enemies when they face you. So you've got one very providential reading, one very naturalistic reading. And then another reading that says it's nothing to do with military strategy, nothing to do with punishing the Jews, either for a failure in military consequences or a failure of their culture. The Jews have a platform to demonstrate God's power all over the world. This is the only miracle that takes place outside the land of Israel, post-settling the land of Israel, that we commemorate in the Tanakh. And this is God's way of saying, I'm not only the God of the Jews, I'm the God of the world. And that made clear when we left Egypt, but you can always read the Exodus from Egypt, not in universal terms. God was saving his people, caring about his people, taking them out of Egypt, taking them to their land. And this was God's opportunity to show the world, I'm here for humanity when there's injustice, and I have universal reach. Those are very, very different readings than we had another nine or eight. I don't remember the exact number. Again, showing that framing history is key, but Chazal don't always offer us a easy pattern that we can all fall into, which means that we should tolerate difference in terms of how to frame events. And maybe the overarching attitude towards history we should have can be summarized with one word, which is humility. We don't know. There's difference in Chazal how to frame things, and all we know is what we're supposed to do now, how we're supposed to react to tragedy, and how we're supposed to react to challenges, rather than how we're meant to define their causes. Those were the introductions, and then we had a number of observations about the first couple of words of the Megillah, Vayhi, Vayhi. Vayhi means there's a tragedy, Bimei Achashverosh, it was Zed of Achashverosh. Why was he called Achashverosh? Maybe he's a brother in spirit of the Rosh, meaning of Nebuchadnezzar, the leading horrific figure, and sometimes Achashverosh is painted as a bumbling jester who's kind of a plaything of Haman, but is rather innocent. And Chazal present a unified front on this, that he is a malevolent force. And it could be he's malevolent because he's bumbling, but that shouldn't be read as innocent. If you're in a position of power, you have a responsibility to be attuned to what's going on around you. And Achashverosh, we said, who Achashverosh? He is Achashverosh from beginning to end, meaning who Berishato, mi Tchilato Vad Safo. He was wicked from beginning to end. It wasn't that he had a change, transformative. He liked Esther. One of the commentaries say, you know, at one moment he kills his wife because of his friends. Right at the beginning, he kills Vashti because his friends wanted to see him. And at the end, he kills his friends because of his wife, because he likes Esther, so he kills Haman. This is an unpredictable, bumbling, malevolent force in politics. And that is a huge danger when it comes to political life. And after we did that first verse, we start going a little further into 127 provinces. He was one of the universal reigns in human history, a superpower. And then we said, oh, how many other superpowers were there? And we said, oh, well, there were three great superpowers. And we said, well, what about Solomon? What about Cyrus? What about Daryavish? We go through a series and we say, well, they're not superpowers in the same way for whatever reason. Shlomo uniquely was not a superpower in the same way because he was an even greater superpower. We suggested Shlomo not only had dominion over earth, but also had some sort of dominion upon high, tachtonim ve'elyonim. And then we said Cyrus was just hyperbole, saying how great he was, but he didn't have that much power. He had already fallen in the measure. And then we had a whole page dedicated to miscalculation. That Achashverosh, we said, took out these kelim, which were the vessels from the temple, and we'll get to that again today in passing. And he said, I'm not going to make the same mistake that my ancestors made. And who made the mistakes? Nebuchadnezzar made the mistake. Cyrus made the mistake. Darius, they all made the same mistake because they were all reading Yirmiyahu, apparently. And Yirmiyahu told the Babylonian kings, this exile, the first exile of Jews, will last for how long? 70 years. That seems simple enough to calculate. So Nebuchadnezzar said, I'm going to count 70 years. And it says, Shivim Lebavel, 70 years of Babylon. So he thinks 70 years of Babylon, how long is the exile going to last? Until the 7th anniversary of Babylon. And he was the first ruler of Babylon. They defeated Assyria before them. And he thought, after my 70th year in power, the Jews are meant to go back. That was a promise of Yirmiyahu. Year 71, what can I do? Whatever I like. Obviously, it didn't happen. So he takes out the vessels and starts playing with them. He miscalculated because 70 years Lebavel, one of his descendants or successors, turned around and said, oh, it doesn't say Lemalchut Bavel, it says Lebavel. It means Legalut Bavel, 70 years of the Jewish exile. So he counted from the time Yoyachin was put into exile. And then he took out the vessels, and it turns out that was also wrong. And overall, we get to the fourth wide line on Yud Bet Amud Aleph, and we went through how a whole series of kings, including Achashverosh, makes this miscalculation. And we finish by saying, not only did all these Babylonian kings miscalculate, who else miscalculated? Daniel. Said, even Daniel said, I was looking back, I was calculating the years, and I got it wrong. I didn't know when to start, when to finish. And again, Chazal seemed to be presenting among this dialogical conversation, the overarching view, calculating the end is tricky and complicated, even when you're told 70 years. Even it seems straightforward. Everyone's making a mess, and people are dying, and people are staying in exile and losing hope, suggesting by inference that when we're not given an exact time of when the exile will end, maybe it would be even trickier to calculate. Maybe we should not focus on, you know, whether it's over and losing hope and falling into despair. And we should have some, again, overarching humility in the face of history. Fourth line. We're now picking up again. And last time I printed out the psukim, and I'm sorry I didn't do that for you now. We're just going to go basically line by line through the first perek of what's going on. There's a party, lots of people here. It's described in luxurious, exuberant terms. What is this scene setting? If you go to current biblical scholars, they'll tell you, the book of Esther is generically, meaning in terms of its genre, almost a farce play that's intended to be humorous, and it starts with a big party, almost like a Shakespearean tragedy. It starts happy and then everything falls to pieces and then it's saved in the end. It's like a nice story. Chazal don't read in those terms, and they see in each of these verses an insinuation about what was so tragic. What was so problematic about this party. But there are some observations along the way about leadership, about politics, about life and about theology as well. So Parasamadaya Paratamim, in one verse, I think this is verse 3 of the Megillah, it says, and there were officers from Persia and Media. And then it says, and there were kings, Madaya Puras, from Media and Puras. And there are two inconsistencies. Number one, Prasa Madaya reversed from one verse to the next. Which one comes first? And number two, it says, on one hand, Partamim, which means officers, and on the other hand, Malche, kings. So, can you just, this sounds confusing. What's going on? Amar Rava, Rava said, Atunuyatun Badadi, the Persians and the Medians made a pact together. Iminin Malche Minachu Efrasche, that if the king come from you 1 year, we'll appoint the officers. Iminachu Malche Minin Efrasche, and if the king come for you 1 year, we'll appoint the officers. Meaning, within the first four psukim, we get a sense that there's a complex political operation, pact making, deal sharing between the Persians and the Medians. This is not just a random king. This is a huge hierarchy and infrastructure which Achashverosh is supervising. Continues, Bahara Otoit, Oshek Fod Marchuto. In this party, he showcased his wealth, his honor of his kingdom. Chazal Rabbi Yosef B'Chanina says, Melamed Shalavesh Bigdei Kuna. We mentioned Indiana Jones last time in the Raid of the Lost Ark, when the guys put on the vestments of the Kohen Gadol. Suggesting here is Achashverosh essentially did the same thing, had everybody dress up in the Big Day Kuhuna. So this is not just, for Chazal, a party that Jews happen to participate in. This was a party designed to break the will of the Jewish hope of return. The vessels are coming out because Achashverosh thinks it's the 71st year. You're not going back. He gets out the Big Day Kuhuna. The dream of the temple is gone. It's over. This is your new temple. And I don't want to draw direct associations, but to some degrees, this is what happens when Jews enter modernity in the emancipation in the 1800s, when there was also a movement to say the dream of the temple in Israel is over, it's done. And the way they did that was not by putting on Big Day Kuhuna, but the reform movement decided to rename synagogues and call them temples, which you still see, Temple Beth El, Temple B'nai Israel. The reason they're called temples in the 1800s, the thought was, because we're demonstrating the temple, that's done. We're no longer dreaming of that. We now have temples everywhere. So Big Day Kuhuna, taken out. Again, I'm not suggesting the reform movement is equivalent of Achashverosh, suggesting that there is a pattern to break hopes of some eventual return. And that's what this party is. It's not just materialism among Jews. This is Jews participating in the excavating of their own hopes. So they get out the... Rabbi Yochanan says he's wearing the Kohen's clothing. And how do I know? Because it says, Yikad Tferet Gulato, the glory and the greatness of what's precious. K'tivhatem l'chavod l'tifaret. And when describing the Big Day Kuhuna, they're called Tiferet. So the word Tiferet is a bridge to suggest that's what's happening in this party. Uvim lo'at ha'yamim ha'eleh. And any of you laying the Megillah? Any of you Megillah readers? Moshe, you do the Megillah, don't you? Oh, no, you do the Megillah too. We have the end of that pasuk. Uvim lo'at ha'yamim ha'eleh. Ah, right. So, what was before Shushan? What did you just say? You said Vimlot Yamim Ha'Ela. Chala Nimsaim Ulashushan. That he got everybody from the kingdom and then Shushan. And the order seems strange. If you're having a party, the first people you would invite are the people who are closest to you, and then the more distant related people. Any of you have had a big party and you're making a guest list. You think, okay, who are my close friends? And then who are the people who maybe wouldn't invite us, but we like it? You go through a list. But this seemed to indicate that Achashverosh invites the Cholanim Sa'im, everyone in the kingdom, and then everyone in Shushan. And now, this is where you get some leadership observation. Rav Shmuel, there's a debate between Rav and Shmuel. Chadama, one says, Melech Pikeh Chaya. This was pretty smart, to invite the people who are furthest away to your party first, and then the people who are closest second. Chadama, Melech Tipeh Chaya. And some say, either Rav Shmuel said, this was a stupid thing to do. This is less applicable in the United States, but at least in the UK growing up, this is a question many rabbis face when they think about how to run communities. Do I put all my energies into people who are less committed, peripheral members who don't come to shul very much, and I'm going to try and draw them in? And that means that usually comes at the cost of the regulars who are there at every daily minyan, who are there for the shiurim. Or you say, I'm going to focus on the core, and the peripheral I'll try if I can, but I can't. And there are pluses and minuses. And here you got Rav and Shmuel saying, maybe it's smart, maybe it's stupid. And what are the reasons? Manda Amar Melech Pikeach Haya, the one who says that this was a smart move, Shapir Ava, Dekarv V'chika Barecha, it's much smarter to reach out to the periphery first, because Dibnei Matye, Kol Emet Dibnei Dibai Mepayis Lu, because the people who are near you, any time you want, you can turn their attention to them. You focus on the periphery, and if it doesn't work out, guess where you're going to find the people who come to Minyan every day? At Minyan every day. So you can always, you know, shift gears and turn to them. Or in the political context, if you start inviting everybody out in the provinces to come, and then you decide, oh, I need to turn my attention to Shushan, that's easy enough to shift gears. They're right here in the city. Run a party for them. Invite them all, whatever you need. Mandama Tipeshaya, but once said this was a stupid political move. He should have been paying attention to the people closest to him. Di Mardube Hanach, because if the provinces rebel against you, Hani Have Kame Bahade, you want the people around you to come to your defense. You want a core of people who are going to rally to your support and defend your interests in the event that things turn sour. And if you only make distant, peripheral, remote friends, and the people around you you ignore, when emergency comes, they're going to say, you ignore us, we ignore you, you're on your own, full stop. So again, Chazal are not always in the business of providing a political map, just providing that there are costs and pluses and minuses, and we should be aware of them all. Shalu Talmidavit Rashbi. We take a slight pause from going pasuk by pasuk, where the students of Rav Shmuel Bar Yochai ask him, why did the Jews of that generation deserve to be wiped out? We've already said maybe we can frame this history differently, but bottom line, God is not unjust. There had to have been some reason that these people could have lived for a year under the specter of their own demise. Why did they deserve to be wiped out? Amalehem, Rav Shmuel Bar Yochai says to his students, Amru Atem, you tell me, what do you think they did to deserve this? Amrulo, and they say, Mipneshenenu Masuda Toshal Torasha, because they ate at that meal. The meal that we've just described, which was designed to break the Jewish spirit, that's why they deserve to die. Imkain, Rav Shmuel Bar Yochai responded and said, if that's true, Shabashushan Yaragu, Shabachal Olam Kulo Yaragu, well then only the people at the party should be held liable. The people who went to the palace should get destroyed. What have the people out in the provinces got to do with it? Those Jews. Amrulo, so the students say, Amorata, fine, you tell us then. You know, why do you make us go through this routine? Tell us what you think. Amalehen, and he said, because the entire Jewish nation had turned to idolatry. That was the key. This party is a symptom of a deeper rot, which was that they had given up on their commitments to faith and religion. It wasn't just that they had lost hope in return. You could have a deep hope in a national revival and have no interest in theology. And Rav Shmuel Bar Yochai says, don't think that the national revival is the only story here. There was an emptiness to their faith, which was far more problematic. And then the response of the students was, V'chi ma'ashav panim yesh badavar, and if it's true that they had lost hope in their faith entirely, why were they saved? Surely they would deserve to die. Amar lehem, and he responded, Heim lo asu ele lifnim. This was not a sincere turning to idolatry. They were terrified. They did have faith, but they didn't have conviction. And surrounded by enemies, they caved. So God also didn't do this sincerely. He said, you want to look like you're turning away? I'll look like I'm turning away, and you'll suffer the consequences of what being ignored feels like, even though I will save you in the end. As it says elsewhere, I will not harm them from his heart. Full stop. So that was a little parenthetical remark about what the problem with this party is, that it's a symptom of a deeper rot, of lack of conviction. We don't have to paint the Jews as complicit in their own demise, but they're at least showcasing that they're happy to go to a party that is designed to show they're not going back, and they're participating, at least performatively, in the end of their own hopes, even if we can't exactly read where they stand inside. And this is Rav Shmuel Bar Yochai, El Chazal, also drawing our attention to, we're not saying this is how they felt, but this is how they behaved, and that's bad enough on itself. B'chatzer ginat bitan ha-melech, and they went into the courtyard, the garden of the palace. Well, where were they? In the courtyard, in the garden, or in the palace? Good question. Rav Shmuel said, what it means is that there were three groups. Those who belonged in the courtyard were in the courtyard. Those who belonged in the garden were in the garden. Those who belonged in the palace were in the palace. I seem to remember my father mentioned me at one point on the 350th anniversary of Jews being let back into England. Happy occasion. They had a celebration in St. James's Palace. Yeah, and you were invited. as a representative of the family. And my grandfather... Yeah, sure. And my grandfather was also invited, your father-in-law, I seem to remember. But the reason you're raising your eyes like that is because you also pointed out there were three rooms for different levels of Jew. And you were my grandfather was very happy that he was in a more elevated room than you. You were out on the periphery. So you were a courtyard Jew and he was a garden Jew. And then there were palace of Jews. Maybe I'm making this up, an invented memory, but I seem to remember you saying there were different rooms. And
there were different rooms.
And there were people who were big donors. And there were people who were...
I think that was the community.
So you were in the periphery. You're not going to tell a story now. No, you don't.
No, you're right. There was one lady who was...
Oh, no. Sit down. Sit down. You can tell the story afterwards. Okay. Either way, so one reading of this is there were three different areas. Again, this is suggesting there is more thought in this party. It's not just a drunken king celebrating. This is a king who is a malevolent force who is purposely trying to put his designs on the people. He is dividing up the public, is what it seems. Chadamam 1 says it's not that they were into different rooms, but Hoshivan Bechatzer V'lahechki Kan, he put them in the courtyard first, meaning he wasn't actually that interested in having them close and intimate to his luxury life. He put them in the courtyard, V'lahechki Kan, but it didn't hold them. There wasn't enough space. Beginah, so he brought them into the gardens. V'lahechki there wasn't enough room. V'lahechki Kan, until he had to let them into the palace where there was room, which also tells you, which may speak to some of the designs we see in the neighborhood, that the courtyards are actually, you imagine the courtyard's big. That's a kind of Victorian model where you've got huge grounds. But it seems to be here, you've got a courtyard that doesn't fit everybody, but the palace is big enough to fit everybody. So you've got a small courtyard, a slightly bigger garden, and then a huge interior space where people can be held and come on in. But I need to tell them there's a third option of what this means. So Shivan Bechatzer, you put them in the courtyard, but he had two doors open, one to the garden, one to the palace, so people could get air and go to different places. Some of you, when you go to restaurants, they may ask you, do you like a seat near the kitchen, a seat near the window? I don't know if people ask that, that's just in the movies. But they, this is what he had. He had a courtyard open, and he said, and there's a garden view, there's a palace view, you decide where to sit. So a huge amount of luxury here. That's how it's operating. Chur Karpas Chelet. And it goes on to say there were hangings of Karpas and Chelet. You're thinking, Karpas? What is that? My Chur. So firstly, what are these Chur? Why is that hangings? What is the implication of that? Rav Amar Chari Chari. It means that it was lattice work with holes in it. So it was, again, we could spend a lot of time talking about why that's pertinent or important. Does it showcase luxury that is also full of holes? It's a hollow luxury, that it's more about aesthetics than it is about substance. But either way, it's describing the scene. Shmuel Amar Shmuel says, it's not that there are holes in it, but milat levana hatziya lehem. It is a fine white wool that was laid out. Karpas, what is karpas in this context? It clearly does not mean they had vegetable hangings like that we eat on Seder. Amar Rav Yosi ben Chanina, karim shel pasim. It means that they had pillows of fine wool that were there as well. And now you're getting the scene. This is a palace with a garden view and an interior view, beautiful seats. We'll get to exactly what the seats are made out of in a moment, with multiple tiers, with hangings and cushions and pillows. And again, the premise of the celebration is, it's year 71, everyone's wearing priestly vestments, the temple's done. You now get to live in the diaspora. And the Jews are, again, they're not malevolent, but they think, if it is year 71, maybe it is over. Maybe we're not meant to go back. Maybe we are meant to join in with this. And they seem to be also allured by this luxury.
Why are they wearing the vet to like mark the Jews or to like bring them down to say you have no hope of ever coming back? Like, what was the point of?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's unclear. He's certainly seen as a malevolent force. This was not a good thing. But it doesn't necessarily suggest that he was making fun of them. But he was kind of saying, come and join in. The Jews thought, yeah, maybe this is our new temple. The priesthood is over. I'll try to say this delicately. To some degree, Chazal are clearly pushing back against this vision. But the idea that the priesthood shifts and doesn't have the same power it used to, and that our dream of return should not be acted upon, talking about the Second Temple period, is embraced, that we are now a diasporic people, we're stuck in exile, we don't act to bring around the Messiah on our own, and we have to figure out a way to survive in public. And the rest of this Masechta is going to be a guidebook to surviving in diaspora. It's very old. Only the first chapter really talks about this part of Purim, and then we'll have some elements about laning the Megillah in the second chapter, and then the whole third chapter of Masechta Megillah seems entirely unrelated, because it's just about shul life. When do we lane? How do we do a Haftorah? Who are the aliyahs? And it seems like, oh, it's convenient enough, you're talking about the Megillah. But if you think about how do we survive in the diaspora, the institution of the synagogue, the shul, is the guidebook, where we have a miniature Jerusalem that we carry around with us. So they're reading back into the destruction of the first temple, kind of a similar moment, but of course it's not the institution of the synagogue they turn to. They turn to the palace. They turn to political power. So the critique might be a bit more fine, but it's not clear that they're mocking the Jews, but it's certainly alluring the Jews to a false aspiration. Okay, so we now know they've got these fine pillows. Al glile kesev umude sheish, they had these pillars of silver, pillars of marble, matot, and seats, zahav v'chesef, made of gold and silver. So the question is, well, what are they made of? You've got to be made of one thing or another. Is it made of gold or silver? Tanya, Rabbi Yehuda, Omer Rabbi Yehuda says, ha'u l'kesef, l'kesef, ha'u zahav l'zahav. Says, whoever was fitting for silver chairs got silver chairs, whoever got golden chairs got golden chairs. So my grandfather got a golden chair, you got a silver chair.
Bronze
chair. At which point, the Gemara says, I can see father and sons-in-laws having a lot of debates about this. That doesn't sound like a good idea. Rav Nechemya says, what are you talking about? You know, people sitting there in silver chairs and gold chairs, they're all going to know you're better than me. Why would a king do that at a suda? Now, to Dror's question, if he was trying to mock people and they were kind of dragged into this, you could see why you would intentionally do this. Put silver chairs and gold chairs, make people think about who's better than me. And that seems to be one vision here. Rabbi Yehuda says that's what they had. They had golden chairs and silver chairs, and they had different rooms that were set up for different people. But Rabbi Nemecha says that's not the image here. Elehem shal kesef, raglehem shal zahav. Everybody had the same chair, and the chairs were made of silver, but they had golden legs. So there was no anxiety at the meal. Everybody was participating in luxury. Bohat v'shesh, and they had these gems that were available. Amar Basi, what are these gems? Avanim shemitchotet ol ba'aleihem. These are gems that were inciting to their owners, meaning the very exciting, shiny gems. As it says elsewhere, avnei nezer b'tnotzes al admato, talking about sparkly gems glistening on the ground. So that's what these gems were. V'dar v'selcharet, and they had dar and selcharet, which if you look in the Altschor translation, will say, what did they have? Dar and Selcharet. So what are these things? Rav Amar, Dari Dari. Dari Dari, these gems were set out in rows, almost like a mosaic. So again, it wasn't just luxurious exuberance. This was aesthetics set up to draw the eye and to show that this was designed in a particular way. Shmuel Amar, Shmuel says, Even Tova Yesh Bedar Karche Hayam. There is a great gem somewhere out in the islands, Vidara Shama, and it's called Dara, Hushiva Ba'emse Sudav Mirelem Katsaraim, and it was almost a chandelier. Sometimes you've got chandeliers now that have bulbs and lights in them, and sometimes you just have an arrangement of stones that is arranged so that it refracts the light in a beautiful way, and that's what this was in the middle of this Suda. Debe Bishmol Tana, in the house of Bishmol, they taught Shakara Dror. There you go. Lachol balei schara. This was not gems. Dar v'sochara. Dar v'sochara was that there was an announcement of dror, of freedom, l'schara, for business. Meaning, if you want to think, what's more important to the Jewish public? To have a sparkly chandelier or to be told no income tax for a year? You leave the chandelier out and we'll avoid income tax. So that was the reading of Rabbi Shmuel of what was offered here. So again, you're thinking about this overwhelming celebration, where you're still haunted by that image of people wearing the Kohanim's clothes, but as it's happening, there are hangings and pillows and silver and gold and gardens and palaces and announcements, there's no income tax for a year, and chandeliers sparkling in the middle, and you think, maybe this is what we're made. This can't be an accident. Why would God permit this? And they're being friendly to us. They're not trying to annihilate us yet. That'll come. But very soon that'll come. But in the meantime, everybody seems happy. And it continues. V'hashkot b'klei zahav v'kelim v'kelim shonim. And they drank from golden vessels. Each and every vessel shonim was different. Mushonim b'alei. And the Gemara says that's a wrong grammatical form. It shouldn't say shonim, which means seconds or repeated. It's a mushunim, different. Amarava yatsa bat kol va'amar lehem. No, there was an announcement at this meal that called out. Rishonim kalu mipnei kelim. The ancestors were destroyed because of vessels. Atem shonim bahem, and you are repeating their mistake. So having spent the last daf saying that Darius and Cyrus and the Nebuchadnezzar miscalculated, they took out the vessels too early, we're saying in the middle of this meal, there was this haunting sense that maybe we've made this mistake again. Again, the literal reading is a voice came out of heaven and said, you're making the mistake. If we were to kind of imagine what the scene that Chazal is setting, is that the Jews now have this ultimate sense, and we are haunted as a people, not only by neurosis, but also by guilt. And here there is a sense of guilt that it's too good to be true. There's something wrong here. And mistakes have been made in the past about vessels, and we're doing it again. Question?
Yes, prosaic question. I don't understand. How many vessels were there in the temple that like everybody was getting a vessel from the temple? And how many vestments were there of the Kohanim? I would have thought it was like one set.
Well, there are a lot of Kohanim. So there, in terms of the Kohen Gadol, it's true there are not many sets, but there are a lot of priests, so there are a lot of uniforms. But you're right, not enough to dress up the entire kingdom. Presumably they had waitstaff wearing the Kohanim's clothing. You had a display of vessels from the temple on the top table or something. But yeah, you're right. It's not that everybody has something from the temple. But yes, it's a good question. So we continue. V'yein malchut rav. And there was much wine. But rav isn't really how you say much. How do you say a lot in Hebrew? Harbe. So what is rav? Meaning, it doesn't mean many. It means august, majority. Right. So amar rav, what is it? Tedu milamed shekol echad ve'echad hishko yarn shegadol emenu b'shanim. When it says great wine, doesn't mean there was much wine, but it means the wine was older than the people who were drinking it. So this is fine wine that had been aged for the occasion. This wasn't an emergency party. They had stores down in the palace where everybody could drink. V'hashtiyah kedat ein ones. And they drank according to the law. No one was forced. What on earth does that mean? What law? My kedat. What law was it? Amram chanam esher rebmeir. Kedat shel Torah. Like the law of Torah. What's the law of Torah when it comes to drinking? Ma dat shel Torah. Achila merubah mishtiyah. There are cultures, Britain among them, I think, where there is a huge amount of emphasis on drinking. You know, you have 14 drafts of Guinness or whatever it is, and you have a little bit to eat as well, but you focus on drinking. But the Jewish law tradition, says Reb Meir, is that we do more eating than we do drinking. Drinking is acceptable, but you've got to fill yourself with substance and just get high on fumes. And the meal itself was designed in that way. So again, to come back to Dror's question, this is not so at odds with Jewish principle. They're drinking kedat, like Jewish law. It feels like they're wearing our Kohanim's clothing. We're eating more than we're drinking. This is not too problematic. We'll see how it goes off the rails in a minute, but it seems straightforward. Ein ones, and it was not forced. Amar Allah. This tells you the fact that it was not ones, it was not a kind of a forced moment. And I confess that I have done this occasionally. If you're a guest somewhere, you don't want to be rude, and they put out food or drink that's not your favorite, you eat it or you drink it. You don't want to say, it's not my thing. Sometimes, someone will give you a l'chaim, and I'm not very good with alcohol, and I don't want to say no. So I sniff it and pretend that I drink it or something. But here, everybody had wine from their own county. So nobody was kind of drinking something unfamiliar or uncomfortable. So it was wine that was older than them. It was from their own county. They were eating more than they were drinking so they could hold their liquor. And this is an odd moment. And they did according to the will of ish ve'ish, each and every man. And Chazal say, well, actually, if you look in the Megillah, there are only two figures who are called ish. And those are Amar Rav Allah Sot Kirtzon, Mordechai v'Haman. Mordechai dichtiv ish Yehudi. Mordechai is called an ish Yehudi, and Haman is called ish tzar v'oyev. So this party was according to the wishes of both Haman and Mordechai, which requires some explanation. I'll just offer one briefly, suggesting that both of them wanted it to be ein ones, that it should not be forced. Mordechai didn't want the wine to be forced on them because he didn't want them to have it. He didn't want them to participate. And according to this reading, Haman also didn't want it to be forced. Why? When are you liable in Jewish law? if you do it intentionally. So he says, don't force it on them. I want them to deserve punishment. So don't force them to do it. Lure them into it. And so Mordechai and Haman are actually allied on this point. Don't force the Jews. One, because they don't want them to do it. And the other one, because they want them to do it intentionally. And this party, this is where it starts veering off the path. Gam Vashti Malka, Stam Ishten Hashim Beit HaMalchut. And also Vashti made a party for women. Where did she make it? Beit HaMalchut. In the royal palace. Beit HaNashim Ba'alein. The Gemara says, surely she should have done it in the women's home. If she's doing a party for women, it should be with a mechitza. Amarava shneim lidvar veirinit kavnu. Both Vashti and Achashverosh were in on this. We need to corrupt Jewish culture. And we're going to give this some presentation that makes it seem familiar. There'll be Kohanim walking around. They're going to use vessels they're familiar with. They're going to drink from their own counties. But slowly, slowly, we're going to start peeling away these Jewish commitments to return to promiscuity, avoidance. And they both had these ideas. Hainu damri inchi, this is how people say. Iu bakri va'atadei b'b'suni, this is how people sometimes say. I personally have never said it, but this is how sometimes say the husband uses large gourds and the wife uses small gourds. Meaning they both participate in the same thing, even if it looks a little bit different, they're both on the same page. Apparently that's a phrase. Bayom hashvi ketov lev hamelech b'yayin. On the seventh day, the king was happy with wine. The Gemara says, Adu ad hashalo tav libe b'chamra. Until the seventh day, he wasn't happy with wine. What happened on the seventh day? Amar Rava yom hashvi shabbat haya. The seventh day of the party was Shabbos. And again, why would the king of Babylon or Persia care about whether it was Shabbos? This was a party, not only that the Jews participated in, but was designed for this aspiration, to change the Jews' sense of self. Shizrael ochlem mishotim mitchalei b'divrei Torah. When Jews sit around on Shabbos, they eat and drink, and they start matchim b'divrei Torah b'divrei tishbachot. They begin with blessings, they begin with words of Torah. Aval avdi kachavim shochlem mishotim. But when these idolaters eat and drink, ein matchilem b'divrei tiflut. They begin with idle chatter, or even worse than that. V'chein besu da'ato shalot ha'rasha, as they did at this meal. And again, enforcing that Achashverosh is a rasha. Halalu omrim. Some of the people at this meal said, midiot na'ot. You want to know who the prettiest women in the world are? And this again, if we think, oh, this is a rivet movie, this is not like crazy that this is the people who would speak at a party. The immediate women are the most attractive women. Halalu omrim. And these people said, Parashat, no, the Persian women, those are the best women in the world. Amalem Achashverosh. And Achashverosh says, in what can only be described as the most romantic sentiment ever, Kli shani mishtameshbo, the vessel that I use, meaning my wife, Enu lo mada ayvu lo parasa, she is not from Media and she's not from Persia. Ela kashti'i, she is a Castian and she is the best. Ritzon chem lirota, do you want to see her? And we're thinking, oh, this is a nice meal. Amru lo, and the people said, in, yeah, we'd love to see her. One condition, vashadei ruma, but she has to be undressed. And again, you know, imagining the Jews have come to this meal under the kind of illusions that this is going to be acceptable. They're drinking the way we drink, with more food than drink. They're giving us drink from our location. It's older than we are. This is fine. Look around. It's beautiful. And then conversation begins. And you can see them squirming. You know, this is very uncomfortable. We start our meal with praise to God. We start our meal with discussions of law. And discussions of stories, and they're talking about who the prettiest woman is, and then one should be dragged here naked, and now you can feel like the penny drop or whatever the thing that you, that sinking feeling in your stomach. We're not meant to be here. This is really, really problematic and uncomfortable. And here we have a little a parenthetical point. The reason that he was about to drag Vashti undressed before the party is because people are judged the way they behave. That we now know that Vashti was wicked. She used to take Jewish girls and force them to be undressed and force them to do work on Shabbat. So don't get your sympathies out for Vashti at this point. She's about to be humiliated and disgraced, it's true. But don't think that that's unjust. She used to take Jewish girls and force them to be undressed. And we can read this as literally naked, or we can say that it was a violation of their standards of modesty. Force them to be uncomfortable and force them to work on Shabbat. So she had what's coming to her. Hainu dechtiv, this is why it said, Achad v'ma'ila, after the Kisocha Mat HaMelech, when the king's fury raged, Achad v'shachar et Vashti, he remembered his wife Vashti with Asher Asata, and what she did, Asher Nigzarele, and what was decreed upon her. What she did and what was decreed, the Gemara says, those are linked, Kishem Shasata, Kei Nigzarele, the king suddenly cottons on, oh, I remember what she did and what happened to her, and he's kind of figuring out providence along the way. V'tana Malka Vashti, and Vashti disagreed to come. Michti, hold on a minute, why did Vashti say, I'm not going to come naked before you? Does she suddenly have reservations about being promiscuous? She brought them into the palace. Priestahavai, she was already an immodest person. Damamari, we already shnem levarveni kamru. They both intended for sin to occur at this party. Why wouldn't she say, you're right, you want to get these Jews? Let me come out naked. You've already allured them with wine and food and luxury and jewels. Why not bring in female nudity as well? My time aloati, so why does she refuse to come? We can learn from here, and this is where there's the famous legend, that maybe she suddenly broke out in leprosy. So actually, the nudity wasn't what would have brought her shame, but it was the condition of her body. She was sick. But and elsewhere it was taught, that the angel Gabriel came and actually gave her a tail. And this is where that midrash is, that Vashti had a tail, and that's why she didn't want to come out. And the king became incredibly angry that she refused to come. Amai, why did he get angry? Why did he get so angry? You know, so she didn't come, so he should have said, fine, she won't come. Get out some other nude. Why is he so angry? Because he said, she sent a message to him that was provocative. She didn't just say, I'm not coming. She said, hey, a stable boy of my father. Because we know Ahasuerus was not from the royal line. She was. And he says, you were the stable boy of my father. My father used to drink 1,000 barrels of wine. Didn't affect his acuity one bit. And you drink a little bit of wine and you're asking me to come naked before the whole party. You've lost it, man. At which point, Miyad, he became very angry. She can't talk to me like this, calling me a stable boy. So the king called in the Chachamim. And now this is something that might strain your credulity. Man Chachamim, who are the wise people that the king called in and said, I need your help, what should I do about my wife? If you're thinking the king of Persia calls in the wise people, who's he calling in? Who are the wise people? His ministers, advisors, that's what you think. Chazal say, no, Man Chachamim Rabbanan, he called in the Jewish advisors. And again, this could be Chazal, you know, read as putting themselves center stage, or them again describing this party as an attempt to make the Jews feel like this is their home. And he says, you, Jews, you're now part of this country. Advise me. What should I do? And this is where you get a tragic, honest response from Chazal that defines far more than just this moment. How do I know they're the sages, by the way? Because it says, Yodei Hayitim, because they knew the times. Yodim La'avashanim V'likvachad Hashem. These are the people who knew calendar making, which were the rabbis, who were both involved with the lunar and the solar calendars. Amalahu dainilahi. And Achashverosh said to these sages, judge her for me. What should I do? Amru, they said, Hechi Navid, we are stuck here. What do we do? Neimalei Katlev, we tell him to kill her. Lamacha pasik lechamra, tomorrow he'll wake up of and he'll be over the hangover. Ubay leminan, and suddenly he'll want her back and request that we bring her back, and we told her to die. So we can't say kill her. Neimalei Shavken, if we say leave it be, don't harm her, kamazalzei mulchata, she is going to look like we don't care about the kingship. We're trying to fit in now. And if we turn around and say kill her, we'll regret it. And if we say let her be, it looks like we don't care about the king. We're trapped. What do we do? Amrulo, they say, Miyom Shachar Beit HaMikdash, from the day the temple was destroyed, V'galina Me'ar Seinu, we were exiled from our land, Natlu Eitza Mimenu, we have lost the ability of political counsel. Ve'en Anu Yodim L'don Dinin Fashot, and we no longer know how to adjudicate life and death issues. And again, this sounds like a political savvy strategy in a difficult situation, but it's also a larger remark that Chazal are making about diasporic reality, that if you don't live a political reality, it's very, very hard to judge life and death decisions. And again, we see this all the time. People who aren't in power find it very easy to protest those who are in power and tell them how they should be doing and what they can't be doing and what's just and what's unjust. And we say, okay, you take the levers of power, you be responsible for life and death, you're responsible for the life of these citizens, for the stability of government, now you make decisions. And Chazal is saying, look, we're in exile. We have the luxury, to some degree, of not being in a position where lives and death hanging our hands, don't ask us to make a decision here. And this is political wisdom at its height. Zilagabe Abon Moav, go to the Ammonites and the Moabites, and this is a little bit strategic, we'll get them in trouble. Go to the Ammonites and Moabites who've been living there for millennia. They've been sitting there like wine still hovering on its dregs, meaning they haven't moved in as long as history goes. The Tama Amrulay and the Gemara responds and says, and they are right to say this, those advisors. There's a verse, the Shana and Moav Mino Rav. It says that Moab has been fresh from its youth. V'shoket to al-Shamrav, it's been still upon its dregs. Lo hurak mechli, a kli hasn't been moved from vessel to vessel. V'gol lo halach, they've never been into the diaspora. Al-Kein amar tamogo v'rech lo namar, that's why its scent remains still, and it is a stable force. So Moab and Ammon, they're not always our favorite cultures historically, but there is a sense in which they have political savvy because they are stable, rooted people. Unlike us, say Chazal, we don't do life and death issues on a political sense. Miyad, immediately when the Chachamim responded in that way, we have these advisors who come around Achashverosh who say, oh, there's an opening. The rabbis said that you should turn to our advisors, the Ammonites and the Moabites, we jump in. I'm Rablevi. Rablevi says, Kol pasuk zal shum korbanot nemo. We're going to wrap up momentarily. Rablevi says, these list of names is more than just, we don't care about their names. Why are they here? There's an insinuation here that this was a key moment when the angels turned to God and these advisors came and the angels can see what's about to happen. Vashti is just the first domino to fall that's going to lead to a power vacuum, that's going to lead to Haman coming in, it's going to lead to potential decimation of the Jewish people. And the angels at this point jump in and say, stop, God, please. I know that they've come to this party. They're participating in the destruction of their own hopes of return. They've been complicit in this horror show that looks beautiful on the outside, but internally is full of holes. And now we're begging you to save these people. Kol pasuk al shum korbanot neimar, and each one of these terms relates to a element of the sacrifice. So, Amr Melech HaShoreh HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the angel said to God, Ribon Shel Olam, Klum Ikruv Levanecha, Karim Bnei Shana, Kederek Shikruv Yisrael Levanecha. Kar Shana, why are we given that name? Because the angels say to God, have any of these people brought fattened sheep as sacrifices to you like the Jews have? They haven't. Don't give them favor. Sheter, why does it say Sheter? Klum hikruv levanecha shtei torim. If any of them brought you two doves, think back the temples and the sacrifices that you admata. Klum banu levanecha mizbech adamah. Have any of them built to you an earthen altar like the Jews have? Tarshish klum shimshu levanecha big day kuna. None of them have used the big day kuna. Dichtu tarshish v'sham v'yashra, as it says in Shemot, describes them in those terms. Meres. Klum mirsu b'dam lefanecha, none of them have stowed blood before you like they used to at the altar. Marsena klum mirsu b'menachem lefanecha, none of them have brought grain offerings to you like the Jews have. Mumucham klum achinu shulchan v'necha, none of them set table in the temple before you. So this is the angels turning to God as these advisors suddenly crowd in around Achashverosh, where the angels saying to God, stop, think about these names. The Jews, I know they're at fault here, but these people you're about to favor, the Persians, are a corruptive people who are pagan in their culture, who have not respected you like the Jews have. Maybe give them a break. The angels obviously fail in this regard to convince God. V'yomer Mumuchan, and a figure called Mumuchan steps in and he speaks. The last person in this list, right? We had Karshan Ashed, Almatat Ashish, Meris Marsana, Mumuchan. V'yomer Mumuchan, and who speaks up? Mumuchan speaks up. Who is Mumuchan? Mumuchan Zeh Haman. This is Haman. Lamanik Rash Mumuchan. Why was he called Mumuchan? Shimuchan and Paranot. Because he was about to have his comeuppance. That's why he's called Mumuchan. At this moment, we introduced him as he's going to get what's coming to him because it will be prepared. Amar Avkana, Avkana says, Mikan Shehejo Kovitz Barosh. And this teaches you the fact that it had a whole list of advisors, and it was the last one, Mumuchan, who spoke, tells you that often the smallest one jumps to the top and gives their opinion. Liot Kol Ish Sored Beveito. And what was the advice, by the way, that was given to Achashverosh when Vashti was misbehaved? He thought, oh, society's going to fall apart. If they see that I'm disrespected by my wife, everyone's going to fall apart. What was the advice? Make all the women in the country subservient. Tell everybody in the country that a husband is in control of their house. Send that message out to everybody. Excuse me. Liot kol ish, sarid beveito, that every man will be a master in his house. Amar Rava. Rava says, this was the most stupid advice you could imagine. Not because they were in the feminist business, but because this was so patently obvious to them that the men were in charge, that it made royal proclamations seem vacuous or impotent or stupid. This is the remark Chazal again make. Amra Rava, ilmale igrot harishonot, if it wasn't for this first letter that went out, suggesting that maybe the angels had succeeded in tailoring this advice so that the general public would think the king was an idiot or a clown, and they would ignore his proclamation. So if it wasn't for this first letter, lo nishtayim asonim sheyitzol, savidu palit, there would have been no survivor of the Jewish people. Amrei, because they said, my high, what is he doing to shadow le'yokal ishabreita? Why is the king telling us that every man should be in charge of his house? Pshita! Afilu kacha breita pishtada have. Of course, even a weaver is a general in his home. So why on earth does the king need to tell us this? Obviously, these letters are just performative, stupid, disconnected. He's in an ivory tower, which meant when the next letter came out saying, kill all the Jews, they thought, oh, the king's at it again. You know, forget this guy. Of course, it took some purchase on the people, but it wasn't as bad as it could have been. Full stop. V'yifkad ha-melech begidim. Now, to replace Vashti, the king set up soldiers, officers, to go and recruit a woman. Amar Rav, Rav said, my dichtiv, there is a verse in Proverbs that says, kol arum ya'aseh badat, the wise always deal with wisdom. We're going to finish with this green. Ksil yifrosh yivelet, and the fool spreads out foolishness. What does that verse mean? And this is also an interesting point that would have been supported by the author of Common Sense, Thomas Paine, and Edmund Burke, and a number of others, that institutionalized force tends to be less effective than the soft hands of influence. And here, how does he find a replacement? Ahasuerus says, I need a new wife. What are the two options to get a new wife? If you're king of Persia, what could you do to get a new wife? Well, you could take one. That's true. And if you wanted to have a kind of a huge entourage to choose from, what are the different strategies to get choice? One option is round people up. The other option is?
Volunteers.
Yeah, put up an ad. Anybody interested in being princess? And here the suggestion is, he decided, I'll use force, and that was stupid. As it says, Kol Arum Yaseh Badat, first wide line at the end, the wise use wisdom, said David. This is David, who in the end of his life, at the end of his life, they said David needs a young maiden. So they just announced there's a need for a young maiden. So everybody with the daughter said, King David needs a maiden. Everybody, let's go take our daughters. We want our daughter to be married to King David. Ksil, what does the fool do? They spread out stupidness. Said he put out officers to go in. Everybody started hiding their daughters. People do not react well to force, even if it's the same outcome as it would be if they were just invited to participate. And this is again where we're seeing a shift, where Ahasuerus, the loss of his wife, gave him a sense of instability, where he was using a kind of gentle hand. Come on in, have a party, enjoy the luxury. Vashti makes a mess. He's setting out officers. He's enforcing the rabbis to make decisions. Things are starting to fall apart. And he recognizes a mistake has been made. Maybe the Jews do still have hope. The 70 years maybe aren't up, etc., etc. And next time we'll start with the Ishi Hudi, chapter 2, where we're introduced to the Jewish man, who is Mordechai, who's given a number of names, and we want to know why those names in particular. We'll start up there next time. And in the meantime, I thank you for your patience, and I wish you all a Shavua Tov, wonderful week. You have benching?